Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight. This is our first function since our dinner, and good to see you all here. Could I ask everyone to turn off their mobile phones? I think actually turn them off because this has been podcast courtesy of Microsoft, so thanks to Microsoft. And we have Jackie Huggins here, so she's well known, so I will introduce her briefly. She's educated at the University of Queensland and at Flinders University, and an extensive background in public service and education, and currently at the University of Queensland. Right. But also here tonight because of her position as co-chair of Reconciliation Australia. As you recall, around this time last year, we had Mark Liedler, the other co-chair of Reconciliation, speaking to us, and in the lead-up to the 40th anniversary of the 1967 referendum, and we thought it was a great idea to have Jackie Huggins here on the occasion of the 40th anniversary, which is on the 27th of May. And we asked Jackie to talk about the 1967 referendum 4 decades later. Jackie, you're most welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Gerard, for that very kind introduction. It's always my first duty to acknowledge that we meet on the traditional lands of the Gadigal people and to pay my respects to them. The Gadigal people are one of 29 clan groups in the Sydney metropolitan area, referred to collectively as the Eora Nation. I pay my respects to the elders, past and present, and to all Aboriginal people and non-Aboriginal people within these boundaries. Thank you very much, Gerard, for the opportunity to speak here this evening. During a week that means more to me than I am able to convey. In some ways, I feel my life has been building up to it for 40 years. The choices I've made and even the person I've become. And it all culminates this Sunday, when together fellow directors from Reconciliation Australia and I will be honoured in hosting for a few days in Canberra survivors from the campaign that led to the 1967 referendum, the most successful in our nation's history by a mile. We've had acceptances from 35 of the original campaigners, many of whom are now elderly and frail. We've been talking with them about the anniversary for over 8 or 9 months, learning about their stories and hearing new stories of people they campaigned alongside. And they have all said the same thing about how the 40th anniversary of this most unusually successful referendum should be approached. But let me come back to this week's commemorations in a few minutes. Because the opportunity Gerard offered me to speak about the anniversary has had me thinking a great deal about my own life, conducting a kind of internal retrospective. And I hope you'll bear with me as I share some of my thoughts and memories with you. I remember the day of the 1967 referendum as if it was yesterday, and see that in many ways I saw that through the eyes of an 11-year-old girl, which I was at the time. And I also remember some of the long lead-up to it. If I was asked to make one more toffee or lamington for a fundraising drive, or to do the hula, or stand on another street corner handing out badges, well, you can guess what I do. My father died when I was 2, and I was raised by a determined mother who was politically involved in the early years. The referendum campaign became my dear mother's life, and it shaped mine. Those social functions and fundraisers were an opportunity to knock on the doors of people who'd never met an Aboriginal person before, and to let them know we were still here after so many attempts to silence us. We children didn't quite fathom the significance of what happened on the 27th of May 1967. I do remember the shrieks of joy after the result was announced, laughter and a mass of tears. Mum told me we would be counted in the census now, along with the sheep and the cattle. She also said we would be free people at last. Free at last. I never quite knew what she meant, only that it was such a big deal. It's a time also that gave me my earliest memories of the struggle that Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people have fought together. Recognising that if a group of us is not free in this country, nor are the rest of us. It's the struggle that at some stage we started calling reconciliation. Lots of people hate the word, black and white people, but it seems to be a word we're stuck with now. And people have to work out for themselves what it means and what it doesn't mean. I reckon it's also about your actions and what you do rather than a label. As a child, I loved to communicate with people and never felt too shy. Mum would take me around on her culture talks and people would ask me questions. Sometimes it felt like a challenge to answer them, but I always tried and it gave me enormous satisfaction. Still does. Like my mother, I always wanted to reach non-Aboriginal people as well as my own. And I suppose this explains in part why I was drawn and keep being drawn to reconciliation. I was schooled by the early reconciliationists in this country. And I think I have reconciliation in my genes. And to me, like my mother, who understood what it meant a long time before the struggle was called anything, reconciliation has always encompassed three things: recognition, justice, and healing. Recognition that as First Peoples of this country, we have existed here for over 70,000 years and are one of the oldest living, surviving cultures on the planet. That we have maintained and cared for land and for people. Justice is about overcoming all the social disadvantages that can be summed up in one stunning statistic, which says our children can expect to die on average 7 years earlier than that of other Australians. I have absolutely no doubt that we can only meet this enormous challenge if we work together as Indigenous and non-Indigenous people who care about it. That we work together with trust and with respect. Healing, because that is really our fundamental goal as human beings, isn't it? And we will only achieve it in this country if we achieve reconciliation. And it ain't going to happen if the spiritual side of reconciliation gets neglected. You can have a so-called reconciliation process, which includes practical reconciliation, where you give a blackfella a house, a job, a car, but if the symbolic is not addressed, then we will never achieve reconciliation in this country. By the symbolic, I mean all the many things that have to do with building a respectful relationship. The balance needs to be right. Many good Australians have nurtured the flowers of this noble cause over the past 40 years. people who understand how much better it would be for all of us to live together respectfully and be able to share in this country in its vast opportunity and prosperity. It was something Australians understood in 1967, if only for a moment, but it has driven and inspired so many people since, more and more people all the time. And not just a certain type of person, left-leaning, religious, or just people who like stirring the pot. Lots of different Australians support reconciliation. They're people who understand when something's not fair and know that something should be done about it. People in business, in government, in media, all the different professions and political persuasions. People you meet in supermarkets. The reason I think more and more people are getting involved in reconciliation lately, and I'm talking more about white fellas at the moment, is that they are feeling not only that they should do something about Indigenous disadvantage, but maybe something can be done about it. They're hearing enough good stuff happening involving Indigenous people to think things can be better, enough to chip away at their misconceptions. But getting there is going to require all of us, Indigenous and non-Indigenous, that we shift out of our entrenched positions. We need to see and learn about what's actually working in improving Indigenous people's lives and think about how we can reasonably apply it in different contexts. We need to be prepared to listen to one another. This week's referendum anniversary is a good thing for Australians to hear about and to think about, because it marks a fine and decisive choice once made by the people of this nation. And the explanation as to why it happened is to be found much earlier than those final 10 years, where we find the stories that tell us much more about the how. The job may be finished in the Parliament and with the vice-regal signature, but the real work was done in kitchens and workplace cafeterias, camps and community halls. This didn't start like any other movement for constitutional change, just because a government wanted it to. It started because enough of the Australian people wanted it to. The stories of the 1967 referendum go at least as far back as the 1870s. When Louisa Briggs stood up against conditions on the Corranderk Aboriginal Station in Victoria. She worked as a nurse at Corranderk to support her 9 children. Until she protested about the starvation level rations and demanded cash wages and was removed from the reserve. The only way Louisa could keep her children was to move around, because she didn't accept government policy like the word of God. People who knew Louisa described her as an audacious and strong-minded person. Her place in Australian political history hasn't been recognised, but her story is one of the important ones on the road to the referendum that took place 19 years later. It's one of many worth retelling now that we are so much better equipped in so many ways to make good the choice Australians made in 1967. And I just love the story of Hetty Perkins, an Arunty woman who supported her family by working as a nursemaid in Alice Springs, but changed jobs and started cooking and washing on the reserve so she could be near her children. Hetty Perkins didn't confront white authority, she avoided it, making sure her children had the benefit of learning around the campfires as well as at school. One of Hetty's children was Charles Perkins, the first Aboriginal head of a government department, set up as a result of the 1967 referendum. Pearl Gibbs' story takes us right up to the referendum. She was from Bororana, but grew up around Ngunnawal people in Yass, At the same time, politicians were deciding which bit of Ngunnawal land to take as the site for the national capital. Pearl had three children, supporting them by working as a cook in the homes of Sydney's well-to-do. Well, I can tell you, Pearl cooked up more than a dinner in those kitchens. When she found out that Aboriginal girls working as domestics were indentured to the Protection Board, she started a campaign that ended the practice. When she found that vegetables delivered to her kitchen door were picked by people who could never earn enough to buy them, she organised a strike by pea pickers on the Shoalhaven. Pearl drew big crowds in the Domain in the 1930s when she spoke for the Aborigines Progressive Association. She was one of the organisers of the Day of Mourning on the 26th of January 1938 and belonged to every group in New South Wales that was campaigning for Aboriginal rights, white and black. And there were so many wonderful stories that help explain what eventually happened in 1967. They show how people can help but also be attracted by courage for good. And the fact that I've mentioned three women here shouldn't suggest to you that there were not a whole bunch of men also working for reconciliation, because they were, both black and white. Australians need to know about these networks of change makers who brought out the best in us, because the best is always there waiting to be tapped by true leaders in our communities. Pearl Gibbs and Faith Bandler are recognised names, prominent players in the better known parts of the referendum story. So is Jessie Street, who worked with Faith in Sydney, complaining she discovered Faith wasting her time making curtains for a new home when she should have been circulating a draft petition. There were Shirley Andrews and Brian Fitzpatrick in Melbourne, Ujiru Noonuckle and Stan McBride in Brisbane, the Dewigs and Don Dunstan in Adelaide, and less prominent, mighty campaigners like Herb Sims in Sydney and Mary Bennett in Kalgoorlie. It's a great cast of true leaders. And for the names we know, there are many more we don't know, and never will, because in 1967 there were just so many Australians who actually got involved. Along with Vukatsi, at the national level, there were state and territory-based Aboriginal rights groups such as OPAL in Brisbane and the Victorian Aboriginal Advancement League in Melbourne, who used their numbers to mobilise around the campaign. People who'd heard about the campaign in their churches or women's groups or trade unions were also there. And they'd tell their families and their friends and workmates, who then told their neighbours. It was many, many conversations that joined in the spirit of reconciliation and became a national determination. The kind of determination I believe I'm sensing again, in some way, in Australia. And I'm very proud of how Reconciliation Australia is using this anniversary to commemorate past great achievements and also to persuade and inspire and, if necessary, entertain people into understanding how much they can do, and they can do that now. I said a few moments ago that the referendum campaigners who are making their way to Canberra later this week all say the same thing about what they want from the anniversary. And it's not about praise or publicity. They want to convey to young Australians that a lot can be achieved when you tap into the best of people. Frankly, they also want to give a whole lot of people a kick up the backside and tell them to get on with it. So it's a good timing all around, because I'm convinced enough Australians are ready now to listen to this stuff. I know, because all the time I'm seeing unexpected people doing unexpected things. Huge mining companies who in the not so distant past were desecrating our sacred sites, learning to respect Indigenous people's aspirations for ourselves and actually supporting us to achieve them. Talking really directly with people about hard issues and seeing them listen, it makes me feel we're getting somewhere in this country. seeing my students get degrees and good jobs and making good lives for themselves. Positive news stories about my people that make my heart sing. Seeing blackfellas and whitefellas working together to make a difference. It sounds so cliched, but it's such a heartwarming sight. Whitefellas don't need to do this work like we do. They choose to get involved in reconciliation and in making a difference for us. They realise they get something special about themselves in return. And it makes a difference for them too. And yet, it's often blackfellas who turn their nose up at the idea of reconciliation, whatever they think it means, some kind of sellout, I suppose. I've never felt that, nor did my mother when she was criticised for getting involved in the early days. My own natural optimism only wavers when I experience racism and when I sense the low expectations of my people from others and from ourselves, particularly our young. The escalating violence in the world and in our communities, inaction still may be around and perpetrated by so many, or action that is disrespectful and manipulative, so destined to generate more failure. Sad things, and there are many, sharpen my conviction that for things to really change in this country, white fellas have to come to terms with the racism too many of them will accept and excuse, even if they don't feel it themselves. White fellas need to look past their whiteness and try to feel what it is to walk a mile in our shoes. There are no excuses anymore for ignorance. There are so many opportunities to learn about history through film and art and music, if it isn't from books or spoken word. Australia does have a black history. And the more Australians who learn it and take it in, the more who'll understand how it is for Aboriginal people. And who will admire our resilience? For blackfellas, what needs to change is being able to accept that reconciliation, however they imagine it, but let's define it as closing the life expectancy gap, was always going to be a two-way street. We have suffered terribly as people, but in most cases now we have opportunities, choices that our parents and our grandparents did not have. We need to make good choices. I also think we can underestimate the amount of goodwill out there among white fellas. From my experience, being able to trust white people, people who are worth trusting, developing relationships with them, and letting them into our lives can be very liberating. And I would never have said this in my younger days, but I too have changed in this whole process of reconciliation. And being involved in reconciliation has brought me into contact with the best of people, both black and white, which is why my decision to retire from my formal role as co-chair of Reconciliation Australia at the end of the year feels very strange and already quite scary. But it's time for me to do other things, and time for someone else to come onto the board of a top organisation. My mentor and friend Cheney helped me to make the call about retiring, and reaching 52 helped me. There's 50. T-double-O. That was last year. As you can gather, I was 11, 40 years, 11 and 40 is 51, okay. I know sometimes people tell me I may not look it, others tell me I do look it. But I have to tell you that I admire the old Murrays in my life, and I want to live long enough to be one of them. I love the idea of growing older and wiser, and for us, it's not a big deal. It is a gift of life. Fred said I should go out on a high, and this anniversary year certainly feels like a high to me, and that's why I'm doing it. It makes me feel that my life has come one full circle from that little girl who watched her mother fight the battle in the early years, I've tried to be a leader like she was, and I've been blessed to have been schooled by the best. Charlie Perkins, Captain Reg Saunders, Evelyn Scott, and others who continue to inspire me. I hope I've repaid them. I've had so many amazing experiences being involved in reconciliation. Most of them have been incredibly joyous, and a couple have been crippling awful. Like the time in 2000, a few weeks before the bridge walk here in Sydney, when Evelyn Scott and I went to catch a cab in Pitt Street after a meeting. People recognised Evelyn. She's always so well dressed and wears that beautiful black hat. She said she's been wearing it the longest in terms of women in our community. And I too had a lovely green suit on. A cab came over the hill and pulled up, and when the owner got out, he completely ignored Evelyn and me, even though we were pulling our luggage towards him. He called out, "Who's going to the airport?" And when we said we were, he just kept ignoring us, as if we weren't even there. It isn't completely an awful memory because the fellow standing in the queue challenged the driver about why he wasn't taking us. In fact, all the people in the queue seemed horrified as they witnessed this racist act. And another man who'd come from further back in the queue asked whether the driver was refusing to take us. I just told him, get in, because I knew if he didn't, the driver would only drive off and find another fare who wasn't black. Another memory I often think about is working on the draft declaration for reconciliation in 2000 with the author David Malouf, who I admire so much. I'm so proud of what we came up with, even though it hasn't been used as we'd hoped for. And there's the memory that makes me smile every time I think of it. The bridge walk in 2000. I'll never forget Sir Gus Nossal saying the day before, "If there isn't 250,000 people walking, I'll be a monkey's uncle." Well, Gus was pretty spot on, according to the official numbers. I still reckon there were more. I have relished every moment of my 13-year involvement in reconciliation, the highs and the lows, walking three paces forward and two back, the magnificent and horrible people met along the way. It's been an unforgettable ride for me. I hope I've made a good contribution. I've tried to. At times it's been very hard, and at times it's been very easy. I know, though, that I am a much better person and a much wiser person for having been involved. And I'm looking forward to spending more time at home and less on planes, although I'm sure I'll even miss that. More time with my loved ones who have had to get used to my absence over the years. And my professional plan is to concentrate on promoting leadership and education for my people. At home in Brisbane, I want to give back and support others who are striving to make a difference. I want to put back to my community around the lessons learnt in reconciliation over the years. And I need to spend more time at the University of Queensland. And I have a lovely man sitting in the audience who gave me that job 10 years ago, Ian Reinecke. Thank you, Ian. I'm still there. But that's my actual workplace. And I was so grateful last year to receive an honorary doctorate. And how I love those guys at work. I've been described in the past as a cross between a street fighter and a public intellectual. Not sure which one is the more complimentary. So what I want to do is I want to have the freedom to say the things I want to say but feel I shouldn't say as co-chair of Reconciliation Australia, to take people on who insult my people. That's how the new chapter looks from here, a few months out. For now, though, I am fully focused on next weekend and seeing the campaigners linking up with people who fought the hard fight, didn't hide their Aboriginality when there really was nothing in it for people to identify as black. And, of course, for those non-Aboriginal supporters, to also come on board with us because it seemed that there wasn't anything in it for them either, but they did. And even some of our own relatives criticised us for being involved in the struggle for the referendum. And after 40 years, it's just so energising to revisit the stories and see how far we've come, to point out the glimpses of real progress in this journey called reconciliation. But of course, to acknowledge that there is still a long way to go. It is, at its core, a liberation movement, reconciliation, something that gives leaders an opportunity to lead and to take people along, as every good leader should, as I hope I've done. I will always think of reconciliation as a fine and noble cause to be involved in. I feel very lucky indeed to have been so closely involved with it for such a long, long time. But this is a movement of today and the future, just as much as it is of the past. This week's anniversary is the right time for it to be imprinted on the nation's psyche as something we have to do. Nobody questions whether a strong economy is a good thing. Nobody should doubt that reconciliation is in all of our best interests, because it's right and because it's absolutely, absolutely in our grasp. Thank you all very much for coming, and thank you for listening.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.